to find their seats, we'll get started with the Q&A session here in a couple minutes. While you're finding your seats, just a couple announcements. If you missed them on the slideshow, our next Cafe Sci is July 8th. We'll be joined by Georgina Terry, the founder of Terry Precision Bicycles for Women and CEO of Heart of Steel Bicycles. And she's giving a presentation called Bikes and Bodies. She has a background in engineering and biology, so it'll be an interesting mesh and talk. Also coming up on Friday, June 21st, is our next 21 Plus Night. These are nights once a month where we reopen the building after hours just for grown-ups to come and have fun at the Science Center. It's only 10 bucks. There's a bar. There's live music. It's lots of fun. Everybody gets $15 in free play to the casino, so it pretty much pays for itself. And that, it does. That event is having a bikes theme, so it's 21 plus bikes. So you can try to ride a unicycle, learn how to braze steel to build a bike frame. Also celebrating our new exhibit, which opens June 15th. Notice the theme, all these bikes things. A new exhibit opens June 15th. It's Bike Science on Two Wheels. So come on back after that opens. That'll be here through the end of the year. So join us this summer. Check out the bikes exhibit. All right, so let's start the Q&A. The way this will work is we have two wireless microphones. Sarah and Margo have those. They will circulate the audience. You're going to flag them down to get a microphone to ask your question. We're going to alternate between the upper section and lower section as much as we can. So if you're waving at them and they don't come right away, it's because we're kind of waiting to go back and forth. They're not being rude and ignoring you. They see you. They're just, you know, trying to alternate there. So you'll ask your question, we'll get the answer. Please try to speak into the microphone. Remember, we are recording these for the podcast, so it's important that you talk into the mic so we get it recorded so everybody can enjoy it later. And we ask it first, try to limit yourself to one question until everybody gets a chance, and then if we still have time, we can go back and do second questions or thirds or fourths, or we'll see how the time goes. So if somebody has our first question, Margo has our first question, we'll turn it back over.
Think this.
You caught a zombie with a photographic memory. What would its brain look?
Well, I mean, we don't know how photographic memories really work that well in normal humans. So I would think I would be terrified of a zombie with photographic memory because they would know exactly where I went and could go back to it at any time, whereas a normal zombie, you could kind of distract them, hide out, and they're going to get wandering off to the next location. So the study of photographic memory, or people who are mnemonists, is a really fascinating field in psychology. And people who have photographic memories are called mnemonists. And the famous Russian psychologist A.R. Luria has a great book called The Mind of a Mnemonist about a person with photographic memory that he studied for 40 years. And at their first meeting, he presented a list of 40 items to this individual and said, you know, I'm going to read you this list and then 10 minutes to read them back to me. And of course, he did pretty easily. But towards the end of his career, as A.R. Luria was retiring, he asked him, do you remember that list? And he remembered every single word, every single word. But we don't know exactly why their brains are different or how their brains are different. So,
well, related to that, why is short-term and long-term memory kind of work differently? And where's the cutting line, the cutoff line?
The cutting off really seems to be based on time. Short-term memories are memories that you can recall briefly within a few minutes. There's a lot of theories about how it exists. Baddeley, I forget his first name, Dr. Baddeley, has a theory that there's like this working memory buffer. It's just a sensory buffer. When I hear the word blue, it stays in my memory for a very short period of time. But unless I really ruminate on it, it doesn't shift into any kind of a long-term memory. And it actually turns out the memory is a very complex problem because, unlike what I said in the talk, there's multiple forms of memory, and long-term memory itself has different time spans. So there's long-term memories that you'll remember for the rest of your life, being there for your first child's birth or things like that. There are other memories that you'll remember only for a few months, and then they degrade into the detail. And the only real thing we kind of know about this is that the degree to which you kind of recall the memories will predict how vivid they are. But in the act of recalling, you also change them a little bit, too. So it's a very tricky subject. And from a neuroscientific perspective, we are just at the tip of the iceberg in figuring out how it works. Yeah?
Some of
had suggested that you repeat the question after you hear it.
I apologize.
I was wondering, you talked about the shuffling talk. What part of the brain controls that?
You mean with Parkinson's disease? What part
the,
of the brain?
The one that you said was not Parkinson's, but rather explained the lumbering.
Oh, the lumbering. The lumbering, so the question is, what explains the, or what part of the brain controls the lumbering walk? That was the cerebellum. And the cerebellum, if you damage that, you get the lumbering walk. What gives you the shuffle, the first walk that I did, that's a degeneration of a larger circuit called the basal ganglia. Basal ganglia is actually a set of brain regions that kind of circulate information throughout the brain. They rely heavily on a chemical called dopamine. And when you wipe out dopamine, you get Parkinson's symptoms. And we know where in the brain the damage occurs. We know what the chemical cause is. But exactly how it's you know, being damaged and the kind of changes to the circuit that are resulting from the disease, we really don't know that much about. That's why there's a lot of really focused science work right now on the roots of Parkinson's disease and treatments of Parkinson's disease. Just on that same topic, when I was talking about brain stimulation, one of the kind of most interesting and fascinating forms of brain stimulation is something called deep brain stimulators, which are used to treat patients with Parkinson's disease and essential tremor. We basically put a little stimulator deep in the brain and turn it on, and it somehow turns off the symptoms. So you can literally see somebody turn on and off their Parkinson's with a push of a button. I know.
What's the latest research on ESP? Is it considered still crazy stuff, or is it scientifically?
I've personally known a professor who tested this many, many, many times, and he has found no evidence whatsoever for ESP. He's found evidence for behavioral guessing, so using body cues and language cues to predict what, you know, the card will be or whether or not, you know, you're close. But the evidence for ESP, is, as far as I know, is not there.
Except for people that experience it, then it's for real.
Even then, we tend to bring coincidences together, and we'll pay attention. It's called confirmation bias sometimes, where we pay attention to the times when it works, and then we miss it when it doesn't. So, where's the microphone?
Up here.
Oh, up there. Sorry.
I read of a device called the God Helmet, supposedly makes people feel the presence of some entity. Does that inform zombieism in any way?
The God Helmet? I wish. The God Helmet is actually a form of TMS. It was originally called the Savant Helmet, too, and it's just basically a non-specific form of brain stimulation. And the researcher who did it, who's out at in somewhere in Australia, was really interested in basically how do you enhance performance? How do you make people smarter? How do you turn a normal person into a savant? But as far as I know, that research hasn't been replicated. It's been very hyped. But those kind of technologies, I think we're still, you know, really getting to understand how the brain works. We know about 2% of how the brain works, and that's double what we knew 20 years ago. But beyond that, any kind of large-scale cognitive enhancement and brain enhancement are really just kind of more marketing than they are science. Where's the microphone out here, Mark? Sorry.
So flowers for Algernon is not going to work, is what you're telling us.
No. There was some anecdotal evidence that you
flowers for Algernon?
Sorry, flowers for Algernon, the short story of a person with autism, I believe, yeah. Right? Who, through science, became better and then went back to being autistic.
But it was also aliens who enhanced his brain or something.
Right. And there's some research that if you stimulate an area of the brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex on the left side, you're about 20 milliseconds faster at responding to cues. But that's about it. That's about as much as the...
That really wasn't my question.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
First, we apologize for showing up late. And you may have covered this, so I apologize also.
All right.
So what about the brain eating and the zombie thing? Is there some sort of...
So the hardcore zombie enthusiasts actually point out that The movie that started the brain eating and zombies was a spoof. It was a satire movie. The Return of the Living Dead was kind of a tongue-in-cheek joke movie. And if you actually look at the kind of classic zombie movies and the modern zombie movies, they're not really attracted to brains. In fact, it's physically impossible for a zombie to crunch through a skull and eat your brain. So it's much easier to get at the intestines than the soft tissues. So the zombies eating brains thing is more of an urban myth. Of course, so are zombies. Next question. Yeah.
The research that you're working on, can it be used in the treatment of or questioning about autism?
There is work being done on the neural pathways and autism. There's a researcher at Carnegie Mellon named Marcel Just who uses the same technology that I talked about that maps out the wiring diagrams of the brain. And he's finding evidence for abnormal connections in persons who have autism, not spectrum, not Asperger's, but full-on autism. And it looks like they have slightly different connections that relay information from the back and the front of the brain. Your kind of frontal areas and your back areas of the brain, the parietal cortex, are in constant communication. They're always arguing with each other, basically, to kind of make your thoughts and your actions. And it looks like his evidence is pointing to that persons with autism have a different connectivity between their front and their back. There's also evidence using similar methods that shows that also the cerebellum looks like it's slightly different. The area that I talked about with motor control is also different in individuals with autism, but we don't know specifically what's going on there. But yeah, so a lot of this technology is being used towards that end. Margaret.
So according to you, these zombies are alive, correct?
As alive as fictitious zombies can be.
So then why is it if you, like, shoot them in the heart, nothing happens?
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't really thought about that before. So I'm actually, yes, I'm working with the 28 days later theory of zombieism, which will allow for killing of zombies beyond just destroying the brain. So, yeah, let's say I'm going with that one instead.
Earlier on, you talked about the tetrotoxins that the voodoo priests use.
Mm-hmm.
You said they affected mainly the motor cortex. Are there any other places that they affected?
No, they don't affect the motor cortex. They affect the muscles, primarily. And that's because it has difficulty crossing a barrier in the brain that protects the brain from toxins in the blood called the blood-brain barrier. Some does get through, but the muscles are particularly exposed to the toxin, and it's the neurons that make your muscles twitch down here that are affected by it. And so that's the way that tetrodotoxin works. Anybody who's actually interested in the topic of tetrodotoxin and zombies, I recommend the book called The Serpent and the Rainbow. It's about an ethnobiologist who went down to Haiti and actually identified the toxin that's used in the kind of voodoo rituals. They don't. They stick mostly in the muscles. Yeah.
Hello. What about psilocybin and LSD? How does that affect the brain?
Oh, and that's actually a re-emerging area of research, and we don't know much about it yet. A lot of the original studies in psilocybin were done in the 60s and 70s, before we really had brain studies. And there were actually really good psychological research done with psilocybin on how it integrates sensory perception and how it affects emotion. But it's been discovered that psilocybin is useful, I think, in a treatment for depression. And so there's been a reinvigoration of studies in the neural mechanisms of psilocybin. But as far as I know, we don't know exactly even what the target of psilocybin is. I might be wrong at that. I'm not a psychopharmacologist, but that's the best of our knowledge at that point.
But Roland Griffith has been doing some research on it, and he had 20 subjects, and 10 of them he gave psilocybin to, and 9 out of the 10 became religious.
Yeah, so that might be that's more of a less of a neural and more of a psychological aspect of the drug. So it's how you deal with the experience itself. And I was referring more to the neural mechanisms of how the drug works.
Right. So. And then, what is it? Manson used psilocybin on his followers.
Lots of people use psilocybin. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And I have some personal experience with that. Not myself. But someone has used psilocybin on my wife and has her under mind control now. So like to talk to you about that later on, if possible.
No, I know. Yeah.
Did you get the chance to explore the phenomenon that might explain why zombies don't attack other zombies?
No, but that's an interesting question. We had originally in this talk a version where we came up with a theory because in our brains there's a set of neurons called mirror neurons. And what these are cells that if I'm reaching for, say, this bottle of water, they're motor cells and they fire when my arm's reaching towards this bottle of water. But mirror neurons will also fire if I watch you do the same action. And they're thought to be kind of involved in these social interactions, these kind of empathetic social interactions that we have when we're trying to kind of put ourselves in other people's shoes and kind of bond with others. There's a whole lot of theories, mainly coming out of labs in Italy, on the relationship of mirror neurons in psychology. So in our previous version of the talk, we kind of said that maybe zombies have dysfunctional mirror neurons. And so they no longer fire when they see humans doing actions, but they fire a lot when zombies do actions. So there's this whole now, you know, empathetic reaction of zombies to other zombies rather than zombies to humans. Though, like I said, the Warm Bodies movie might throw that theory out the water. Margo.
The chap that did the Serpent and the Rainbow, mm-hmm. didn't he also find that people were mentally suggestive?
I don't remember if that was discussed in the book or not. He said that there was another chemical that they were that the people who were taken as slaves were exposed to that made them lethargic all the time. And I think he said that they were suggestive in that they were basically constantly doped while they were in the fields. And that was when, because the main character that he kind of followed, who basically escaped from his captors, the book surrounds a person who was found wandering back in his home village about 13 years after he was thought to be dead. This is a scientist who wanted to go figure out how he did it. And as soon as he left the fields and escaped from his captors, he started being more coherent, less suggestive. And it was thought that they were basically keeping them doped up so that they would be compliant. But there's also lots of possible damage that can happen with tetrodotoxin due to something called hypoxia. So when your breathing gets shallow, you're depriving your brain of oxygen. You do that too much, you can get this long-term damage. And so there were patients that he talked about that just were mentally ill, and presumably because of prolonged brain damage.
And I thought I also recalled that since you were saying the muscles were paralyzed with the drug that he found, that the original zombie movies were based on his research, and I assume that meant also the lurching walk.
So I actually had a chance to talk with George Romero, the director of the Night of the Living Dead movies. That was that one moment where I checked off lots of bucket lists. So we were at a convention, a zombie convention, doing this talk. And George Romero, Brad and I came up with this elaborate theory about how zombies move and why they activate zombies. It was really nice neural theory to combine it. And we asked George, we were like, okay, so why is it that zombies move the way they do? And he's like, they were dead. I figured they'd be stiff. And as a scientist, I was like, okay, parsimonious, that makes sense. I gotcha. But we have this really cool theory. So that was for George's thing. Actually, if you look at the original Night of the Living Dead movie, he never calls them zombies. He always calls them ghouls. So the term zombie was actually taken after that movie. And his whole thing was just that, you know, rigor mortis, and when you're dead, if you're rising back up again, you're going to have that. And that's why you do the things you do. That was a very humbling moment. Yeah, up there.
One thing you didn't mention in the talk, and I didn't know if you were going to get to The Walking Dead or not, was the character Michonne removing the arms and the lower jaws of the zombies seemed to subdue them in a way. Would that have any link to neurology where if you eliminate the means, you eliminate the desire as well?
You're talking about, what's her name, Michonne
Michonne?
Yeah, there you go. There's not really a good psychological or neural theory why that would occur. There is an interesting thing about hand movements and communication. So if I have you, we naturally gesture when we talk, right? We do this kind of pantomiming of our actions. If I strap your arms down or have you like sit on your hands and try to hold a conversation, it is exceedingly difficult. And it's because you really want to move. You're trying to get these gestures because we think there's this intimate relationship between physical gestures and communication. And so it's a natural thing to do. So removing that action makes it difficult to communicate. But as far as I know, that's the only thing even remotely close to that.
Hi. I was wondering you were talking about the rabies virus, and I have mm-hmm. a very big interest in virology, and I was wondering if you know exactly why it is common for people with rabies to have a fear of water and other type things.
No, I'm not sure we know the root causes, or at least I'm not familiar with the root causes of hydrophobia in persons afflicted with the rabies virus. I know that's a very common symptom, and I think it's a common symptom when it's near death, when you're past the stage where you can get the antiretrovirals. So that might have something to do with, we know a lot about the neural circuits of satiety and you know, when you're done eating or when you're done drinking, what makes you thirsty and what's not. And it's regulated by an area of the brain called the hypothalamus, primarily. So it's possible that the virus is attacking the hypothalamus or affecting its results. But as far as I know, I'm not sure why that is.
And then also, how do you think that certain neurotransmitters can affect what a zombie can do? Like, do you think that they do release dopamine, serotonin, all these?
I mean, yeah. So I would say that, you know, as far as we use a whole plethora of neurotransmitters, they use a whole plethora of neurotransmitters. If I could tell you how neurotransmitters fully relate to human behavior in normal humans, I'd have the Nobel Prize. So that's a very, very complex but good question. And a lot of times there's some fallacies that are involved. So, for example, a lot of people talk about dopamine as being the happy chemical of your brain, right? If you're feeling happy, you get this rush of dopamine in the brain. And so because of that link between elated mood and dopamine, people will call it the happy chemical. But dopamine is involved in a lot of things. Movements, decision-making, all sorts of things that have nothing to do with your mood. A lot of times we kind of make these very simple relationships between specific neurotransmitters. And that makes it actually a little bit more difficult to think about the problem because, you know, what they're doing in the brain is far more complex than just making you happy or sad. Where are we up top? Okay.
I have two questions. Having ADHD, I was wondering if that would make somebody more prone to zombieism or CDHD, since you already have...
As far as you know, there's no correlation between ADHD and CDHD. With things like CDHD, there's this kind of hyper-engagement of areas in the front of the brain, the frontal lobe. And so it kind of makes it difficult to kind of stay on task, which is why a lot of the drugs that are used to treat ADHD are stimulants that kind of engage the frontal cortex. You could probably give some of these ADHD drugs to zombies and it would make them less distractible, but that, in my mind, wouldn't be a good thing. So, yeah, Margo.
Much of your presentation was tongue-in-cheek, but mm-hmm. I have a serious scientific question.
Okay.
If you have a werewolf, a vampire, and a zombie, which one would win the fight?
Oh, man. I'm a hardcore horror movie fan. The question is, if you had a werewolf, a vampire, and a zombie, is that right?
Yes.
Fight. Who would fight? Now, zombies aren't isolated hunters. They hunt in herds. So if you give me about 100,000 zombies, I think they'll win out every time. As far as werewolves and vampires, that's more of a Twilight question. I'm not 100% sure. But there are actual people who do simulated fights and battles between them. This is actually an area that people do a lot of fun computer simulations with.
So that's not your area of expertise?
That's not my area of expertise, but there was a television show I watched once, and I think the zombies, or I think the vampires always won. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, up there.
So considering we're in the Bayer Center right now, I'm curious, you know, you're talking a lot about scientifically how the chemicals work and about all of these ailments or
diseases,
diseases, whatever. I want it politically correct. So can you speak a little bit about the future and how drugs might interact with that? And right now it seems like, you know, you give somebody a drug and it kind of treats it on a really universal level, and it doesn't pinpoint down to the exact causes and where we're headed with being able to really treat some of these diseases.
You were asking a fantastic question. The question is where's the future of pharmacology and neuroscience, and what do we understand about the relationship between drugs and the brain? You're asking a question that thousands of scientists are trying to answer today. I think we've started moving away as a science from the kind of drug-all-cure approach to different diseases, or even just understanding how drugs and chemicals relate to the brain, and taking a more nuanced approach to understanding that things like experience and drugs will interact. So if you take the mental health world, for example, treating things like depression used to be you take a pill. And once we discover new pills, you'll feel better. But it turns out that for long-term benefits, things like pills and therapy or experiential therapies work better than drugs alone. So there's this interplay between our experience, which in and of itself stimulates neurochemicals, just like drugs. So we can make ourselves happy by taking a happy pill that stimulates dopamine, or we can make ourselves happy by eating ice cream. It's the same chemicals in your brain that are going out. So when you really think about it, a lot of our experiences are acting like pharmacology. And we're taking that more nuanced approach when we're trying to understand the relationship between neurochemicals and the brain. But as far as where we are with that, I would say that we are not even close. We know general principles. We know most of the chemicals that are in the brain. But even when I say that, it seems like every day we discover a new chemical that's involved in the transmission of information in the brain, or how known chemicals work in different ways. So it's a gigantic area of research that I think we're really just beginning to understand. Marco.
Can any parts of the brain be transplanted yet?
Can you repeat that?
Can any parts of the brain be transplanted?
Be transplanted? You mean moved from one individual to the next?
Yes.
No. As far as I know, and you know, there might be a whole bunch of research in other countries that are trying to do that, but as far as I know, you can't transplant neural tissue from one individual to the next. And it would seem like, from what we know about immunosuppression necessary for transplanting things like arms and, you know, hearts and lungs, that the body's immune system would really fight back against anything in the brain just because there's a large immune response in the brain. So, but I might be wrong. Maybe people are transplanting that now. So, where are we up there? Okay.
So, when you were talking about prosopagnosia as, you know, sort of the most likely diagnosis for why zombies don't recognize anyone. When you're looking at behavioral treatments for it, oftentimes people are paying attention to other cues. For instance, mm-hmm. the voice will spark it, or when you're looking at kinesics, body language.
Right.
When we're trying to understand the recognition of body language, do we look to a particular area like FFA, or do we look to an appraisal of signals from, you know, patterns of mirror neurons firing?
So as far as I know, when we're using, so the question is what do we use to kind of detect the movement cues that we use to recognize me from somebody else if I can't recognize my face? Is that a good rephrasing?
Yeah.
Okay. We use a lot of cues for biological motion to do that. So we look at how things work together. And there's a lot of research being done on how the brain sees biological motion. And it looks like areas of the brain right back along here in the superior temporal sulcus, and the back temporal lobe are involved in detecting motion and detecting specifically biological motion. And it's in those patterns of, say, how my arms swing in relation to my legs that is uniquely identifiable, not as only as being an animal moving, but of being me moving. And so they think a lot of the identity in movement, in that kind of movement detection, is involved in this kind of biological motion detection.
So putting that in zombies?
So I would say, and actually if you look at the model of the zombie brain, that area is intact. So they can see biological motion just fine. Yeah, Margo, over here.
This isn't a zombie question.
Okay.
My daughter might think it is. She's 19. I'm in my 50s, and I will often, like, go into a room and completely forget why I went in there. And I know, okay. And then I'll come out and go back in, and I'll remember. I wanted to know what part of the brain that's affecting, because I've asked my doctor, and she says, like, oh, How old are you? Yeah, that happens. So what exactly is happening, and why is it more prominent when I'm extremely tired?
So let me point out that I'm in my 30s, and I do that too. I walk in. I know I'm in my 30s, and I do that too. I'll walk into a room, forget what I'm doing, walk right back out. And I think my partner studies aging, and she could probably answer this better than I can. But as far as I know, it's just we're able to kind of pay close attention to details less as we get older. So there's lots of evidence that when we walk into a room, particularly if there's like distracting information, as you get older, it gets harder and harder to suppress that distracting information. That's why I used to love to study and do work at coffee shops, and now I can't do that because it's too distracting in coffee shops, whereas before I could just tune things out. And when I'm distracted, I forget. So I'll notice that I walk into a room and forget what I was doing when I was thinking about something else, really. Like, I'll say, I'm going to go get my keys, but I also have this work thing playing around my head, and by the time I walk into the room, I'm just like, why am I here? And it's just a natural aspect of aging that we lose that ability to kind of allocate priority to things that we need to pay attention to. Our attention just goes down in general when we're tired. So you just kind of zone out when you get tired. And I think that's probably the reason. But that's more of an opinion than a scientific fact. Where are we up there? Okay.
Any theories regarding why zombies turn to cannibalism and not vegetarianism, or why don't they just go after the celery supplies? Or
so why don't we have vegetarian zombies?
Right. Well, I mean, they could go after anything. They go after human flesh. Do you know why? Or do you have any theories why?
No, and actually, if you watch some of the zombie movies, they don't just go after human flesh. They'll basically go after anything that moves. Like in The Walking Dead, they'll see, like, you know, devoured deer and stuff like that. And the idea is that they can't be satiated. So there's a whole other, when we're working on the book, we're working on circuits involved in hunger and satiety. So when you're eating something, there has to be a part of your brain that says, okay, we're done, like, you know, hold off, no more food. And the idea is that zombies are ravenous because they never feel full. They're just eating everything that they can. Now, why they don't eat other zombies? Well, maybe rotting flesh doesn't taste that good. That's going to be one theory I'm going to play around with. But the zombie auto-cannibalism and cannibalism theories are kind of interesting dialogues in the zombie fanboy culture. And I'm not exactly sure why that is. Yeah, Margo.
So since we have such a zombie expert here, if the zombie apocalypse happened tomorrow, what are some good tips and evasion strategies for us?
Oh, I wish I had kept these slides. I had the slides of surviving the zombie apocalypse. Actually, let me see. Do I have them here? So the question is, do we have any tips for surviving the zombie apocalypse? Yes, we do. Okay. Thank you. I've been dying to use these. We actually have an infographic that was featured on Wired if you want to take a look at this. This is what these are up. So tip number one, don't fight them. And this is based off of some work that zombies can't feel pain, right? No matter what you throw at them, they don't feel it. So you're not going to really win in a fight, one-on-one fight with a zombie. Two, keep quiet and wait it out. So remember, zombies are distractible and they have poor memories. So if you can find a place to hide, if you can keep quiet, they're going to stop hunting you as soon as something else or somebody else comes along and gets distracted. So if you can wait them out, you can see the herd move somewhere else. As where possible, distract them. We saw the fireworks example. Because they have this disengagement deficit, if you throw more distracting things away, they're going to stop paying attention to you and stop paying attention to them. Four, outrun them. This only works with the slow zombie variant. But if you're in, if you're fighting against the slow zombies, you can always outrun them. Just run fast. Let's see, five. If all else fails, mimic them, right? They can't recognize you by face. They're only using your kind of kinesthetic cues, so start acting like them. Groan, cover yourself in blood. Walk with a stiff leg. Maybe get a little drunk while you're at it and just really get that going. And if you do that, those are some really good survival tips that we can use to kind of survive the zombie apocalypse. Thank you for letting me use those slides. Okay. Where are we up there? Okay.
If you go with the Walking Dead model of zombies, it seems they have at least a normal sense of smell, because the Grimes gang had to cover themselves with the blood. But how do you account for the fact that the olfactory bulbs sit under the orbitofrontal cortex, and that appears to be missing in the zombies? So I assume the olfactory bulbs are gone as well.
That is a good question. So the question is why is it that zombies appear to have an intact sense of smell, even though the area of the cortex that's involved in olfaction, the olfactory cortex, is actually in the orbital frontal cortex, which I said was damaged? And you found a hole in my theory. Nice. Normally, actually, in the real world, when you get orbital frontal cortex damage, the principal cause is head trauma to the front of the head. There's a type of injury called coup contre coup. So what happens is you bang your head in the front, the brain all pushes to the front, and then it shears back. And what happens is that we're kind of suboptimally designed. There's sharp fragments of bone that poke up from our skull right underneath the orbital frontal cortex. So if you get a coup contre coup damage, it kind of shreds the orbital frontal cortex, and you'll get orbital frontal damage. You get symptoms like what I described. You get impulsivity, you get behavioral control problems, attention deficits. But you also get anosmia, which means you lose your sense of smell. And that's because your sense of smell is really holding on literally by a string. There's one little neural cable that goes up from your nose into your brain, and it's going through this very sharp hole. So in that process of shearing, it actually tends to cut that cable. So people who have orbital frontal cortex damage also tend to lose their sense of smell because of that. I would say that probably what zombies are doing, if I wanted to hold on to my theory, they're really using their sense of taste as an alternative sense of smell. Like snakes. Yes, down here.
Most likely, if you had mental disorder, you'd get some sort of drug, chemical. Are there any therapies like that involve magnetics or electrical stimulation? Or could you wear a helmet to cure mental illness? Or is there any other therapies other than drugs?
There's an emerging field of neural stimulation as therapies. And I mentioned that a little bit at the beginning with transcranial magnetic stimulation being used to treat depression. And what you do is you kind of numb out the area of the brain that's hyperactive that's causing, like, depressed mood. So you kind of suppress it. And that it alleviates some of the depressive symptoms, but it's very transient. So these kind of, like, put on a helmet and stimulate a brain and kind of change the cortical excitability are very brief. The more permanent types of stimulation therapies that are out there are deep brain stimulators. You put a little microchip in the brain that sends out these electrical pulses at very rapid rates. It kind of just stimulates and overloads an area with electricity. And that's what's in Parkinson's disease. What they use towards the tail end of the disease, neurosurgeons will put in these electrodes deep in the brain in an area called the subthalamic nucleus. And what happens is that electrical stimulator is connected to a wire, and then it's run through your skull, and it stops right over here in your heart, and you have your switch that you can turn it on and off over your heart. And that's a profoundly effective technique in Parkinson's. You literally see people's, as I said, you can kind of turn on and off the disease instantaneously. Now, there's some worry that that's the kind of last-ditch effort in the progression of the disease. And so once you've gone to DBS, there's no other kind of cure, and eventually that will wear off. But there's a lot of potential there for deep brain stimulators and similar kind of permanent stimulators in treating different types of mental illness. The first step is to figure out, though, what's the root of that illness. And that's where neuroscience is, I think, still kind of in its infancy. Even with deep brain stimulators, we don't really know exactly how it's working. We just know that it is working. We just know that we put it in this one location and it shuts off this tremor. It shuts off the behavioral kind of twitching movements. But we don't know why or how. Oh, yes. So an alternative is also ECT, which is used to treat severe depression, though. And the marketing for TMS is the kind of lighter version of ECT that you'd use in less severe patients. ECT is electrical pulsive shock therapy. And in that one, that's a severe intervention where they drive electrical current through the brain and use it to induce a seizure. And what it kind of does is acts like a reset in the brain for people who are so depressed that they can't even get out of bed. And the switch is almost night and day, but it's a pretty drastic intervention. Yeah, up there.
Yes, I'd like to know if you've heard of what's called the zombie cell.
Hold on. Could you say that again?
The zombie cell, it's research that's been done. I think,
oh, yeah, yeah.
University of New Mexico.
Yep.
What your take is on that as far as how they could use it in sciences with
the the zombie cell, that's from my hometown, so I'm from New Mexico. So the zombie cell is actually more of a marketing technique than anything really related to zombies. The zombie cell is where scientists have replaced the lipid tissue of a cell with an artificial polymer. And when they do that, a cell that was dead kind of starts to come back to life a little bit, and it's protected. Basically, you can think about it as putting a coat of armor around an individual cell. So they call it zombie just because in order to do the replacement, the cell temporarily dies, but the mitochondrial action in the cell doesn't really stop. So it was kind of a misnomer more for marketing, but the potential for having our cells have kind of armor coating is amazing. I mean, talk about bioengineering. If you could put on a skin where you no longer got sunburn, that's what these kind of zombie cells could do. But that's, again, they did it on a couple cells, and that's it. So it's still a relatively new technology. Yeah, Margo.
One of the things you mentioned was how certain things get into the body and affect the brain. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I believe you mentioned were inorganic proteins mm-hmm. that enter the body. My question is, how does a foreign protein, which is inorganic, get into the body and start affecting organic tissue?
The question is, how do inorganic compounds like prions get into the body in the first place? Do you remember the incidence of mad cow disease that came around like 5, 6, 7 years ago? Mad cow disease is a prion disease. So you eat an infected piece of meat and you'll get this prion disorder. I think that's more of a peripheral disorder. Individuals with Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, it was first diagnosed actually in cannibals who would eat neural tissue. So you have neural tissue that has prions in it. So at some point, somewhere in history, somebody's protein tangles created a little prion. But it has just so happened that it was in a culture where they did cannibalism and they ate brains. So when they ate the brains that had the prions, they ingested the prions, and it would cross the blood-brain barrier and affect the brains the same way. It attacks the specific brain cells. So just like when you eat a toxin in your food, you eat a severe dose of weed killer or something in the food that hasn't been washed, and it can affect your neural responses. Prions would be the same thing. Yeah, up top.
Is there any research being done with stem cell and growing brain parts?
There is. The question is there any research being done in stem cells and growing new neural tissues? The last time I heard that the extensive research on that was, again, in Parkinson's disease, because Parkinson's disease arises from when cells in a particular area of the brain called the substantia nigra, which generates a lot of that chemical dopamine, start to die off. And what they were really hoping to do is use stem cells to regrow those cells. So you would put stem cells in the substantia nigra, and they would replace whatever cells were dead and basically regrow that circuit. That's the last time I've heard of really extensive work being done on it, but I think there's a lot of research that I just don't know of that's being done in that domain. The problem with Parkinson's disease and stem cell treatment is that there's some toxin, there's something that's attacking those cells. So when they put the stem cells back in, whatever it was would attack them again. So until we can kind of know the root cause, I think the stem cell therapies are going to be fairly limited in that case. Where are we at?
Can your research shed any more light on why football players like that have too many concussions, why they acquire these diseases later in life? And is it just from shaking, or is there any particular nerve damage you can do?
So the question is there any research, or what's the research on why football players or boxers get these syndromes later in life, where you have chronic concussions and you get these behavioral changes? There's a lot of research being done on that right now. The NFL just put through a major grant to study this disorder. The group that's studying it the most right now is actually the military, because soldiers with better head armor are getting more repeated traumatic brain injuries, and they're coming back with behavioral symptoms. And it looks like, this is just the kind of current theory right now, is that when you get a lot of this jarring,
those fibers that I showed you kind of break a little bit. But we don't really see them. It's not really easy to see them with conventional imaging. So over time, you're just kind of shearing more and more of the connections. It's like fraying the wires behind your television set. You know, a few of them is going to cause a little bit of maybe some chatter here or there on your screen, but you do a lot of them, and it's just difficult to see the picture. The same thing is true in the brain. If you're kind of jarring and shearing a lot of these tissues that you're not going to regrow, then over time, you're going to get these profound behavioral changes. You're going to get depression. You're going to get memory loss. You're going to get these kind of punch-drunk syndrome conditions. And that's the running theory right now. So you repeatedly injure your head, you're doing more and more of this shearing. And over time, you just break enough cables, you're going to cause something severe. Now, the type of research that I work with, the imaging technology, diffusion imaging, is hopefully going to be able to at least see that damage. And the military is investing a lot of research, particularly here in Pittsburgh, to use this technology to see where that damage is. And if we can see where the damage is, we can at least start to develop behavioral therapies or drug interventions that target that specific damage. And that's really where our hopes lie. Yeah, down here.
So what actually causes the humans to die long enough that, and then actually come back alive as zombies
after like days
human
of
help?
Wait, say
come
again?
Back alive.
What causes them to come back to life in the first place? Oh, I don't know. Again, we're still trying to find the root cause of zombieism. Yeah, so the resurrection thing is a little interesting. The reanimation of tissue and the reanimation of like neural responses, we don't know a lot about that. We know about stories of like people falling into an icy lake and being dead because they're frozen, but then being reanimated back to life. But in that case, what happens is the metabolic demands of the body go so small, they just kind of shrink down to non-existent, that you don't really cause cells to burn out. And that's what allows you to kind of be dead and then come back. But in this kind of a case, I don't know what causes zombies to reanimate once they've been buried for like 3 days.
So you said that slow zombies and fast zombies depend on how long they stay dead for. Then why are they regional?
Why are they specific to certain regions?
Yeah,
zombies are from England. Our hypothesis is that whatever attacks the brain attacks the front first and works its way back. So you're not really, you have extensive brain damage before you die. It's just that once you die and you lose those resources, there's a whole other wealth of damage that occurs. So that's our running theory, is that when you're infected with the zombie virus, bacteria, you name it, it's attacking the front of the brain already, and it just causes you to die. And when you're dead, some hypoxic damage kicks in and causes the rest of the damage to occur. And that's why you have more extensive damage with long resurrection times than short resurrection times. How's that for a hand-waving question?
One last thing.
Sure.
How did you ship the zombies from England back to here to study them?
Frozen military transport.
So Jesus was the first zombie?
No, that is actually not true. No. So there's the group that we work with, the Zombie Research Society, there's a whole blog post about whether or not that's true. And by definition, the zombies come back undead, whereas in those cases, you come back to life. And so that's a different situation altogether. Yeah, up there.
Yes, I hope I'm saying this right. Pineal. Where's that gland located in the brain? It's a pineal.
The pineal gland?
Yeah, and what does it regulate?
The pineal gland. Oh, where's my neuroendocrinology background? The pineal gland sits very deep in the center of your brain, and it regulates kind of your hormonal responses. It's the last time I checked, it was involved in releasing melatonin for you to go to sleep and regulating your circadian rhythms. So the rhythms that cause us to go to sleep and wake up in a regular timeline, it's responsible for a part of that. It doesn't drive the whole system, but it's a key player in that system. Yeah.
Hi, I was wondering, I'm fascinated by prions and such, mm-hmm. and so I've been doing some reading, but my question is, how exactly do you know exactly how these proteins tend to misfold, or and how they convert other proteins in your brain to misfold as well when they
no,
get in the brain?
No, I'm not a biophysicist, so my background is fairly limited in that. I think what happens a lot of times, if I know this correctly, that unfolding actually happens a lot of the time. It's just every once in a while, the unfolding happens in such a way that it causes this kind of cascading effect. So we've actually got billions of quasi-prions happening all the time. It's just every once in a while it flips and then causes this kind of cascading effect. But the molecular mechanisms that cause it, I have no idea. We've really only known about prions for, the last 20 years? I mean, you've been reading up on it. You probably know more than I do. So I think we're still kind of trying to understand where they originate and how it occurs. And now we know the molecular shape. We know how they tie. We don't know why. So.
And then my other question was when people take, drugs, methamphetamine, mm-hmm. Cocaine, you name it, it'll actually, I believe, you become sort of dependent on that through the reward pathway, and it increases dopamine production 100,000s fold. Mm-hmm. Do you think that has anything to do with, zombies and dependence on certain things and substances?
You mean the flesh addiction of zombies?
Sure,
well, actually, anytime that we are in it, I wouldn't say anytime, but with a lot of neural chemicals, when we ramp it up, our body wants to maintain stasis. So the chemicals have these receptors on all your cells. Your cells have specific receptors for specific chemicals, and that's what affects the cells. So what happens is when you ramp it up enough, your body's like, oh, okay, we have way too much of this chemical floating around, so start pruning off some of these receptors. So what happens now is when the drug wears off, you're kind of at a lower level. So to get back up to that original baseline, you need to take the drug again, just a little bit more. And over time, this modulation occurs. So you downregulate all the receptors in your brain that are related to the drug that you're taking, and after a while, your baseline is no longer your baseline, it's down here. And it's because your body's adjusted to it. So, that's just the kind of standard form of habituation that we see. So it's possible that, maybe zombies are kind of rehabituating their baseline for flesh. And that's why you see this dependence on it. I'm going to ask down here. Oh, what part of the brain is responsible for human herd behavior? The question is, what part of the brain is responsible for zombie herd behavior? We don't know a lot about it. There's an emerging field called social neuroscience that's really kind of interested in these bonding questions, what it is about the brain that allows us to kind of bond with others and form cohesive units. There's some really interesting research being done at Carnegie Mellon University about this. But as far as we know, not quite yet. We don't know exactly what it is. The best theories we've heard so far is that some mirror neurons, those neurons I was talking about before, have something to do with it, but we don't know what. So.
Attention to this gentleman's question earlier. Does a fast zombie become a slow zombie, or is it always a fast zombie?
Oh, chicken and the egg. Does a fast zombie become a slow zombie, or does the slow zombie become a fast zombie? Oh, will a fast zombie always be a fast zombie? Actually, I haven't seen World War Z because I don't know, or at least in the movie. The book is fantastic, but the movie's horrible, it looks like. All of the fast zombies seem to be the kind of more biologically reasonable zombies, like 28 days later. And in 28 days later, zombies are not dead. They are actually infected. So the movie 28 Days Later, people are infected with a rage virus that just makes them so blood angry that they do horrible things. But eventually they just starve to death, right? And eventually they just kind of wean themselves down and burn themselves out. So if we're going to go with a biological model, I would say that eventually fast zombies will become slow zombies just because they're going to wear themselves out. But yeah, that's a good question. Any more up there?
The question I was going to ask is, how come in most of the zombie and with some of the research that you've done, why do they not fight over their own food?
Oh.
They don't attack each other. It's more of a herd mentality like she was referring to before, but you don't see a hierarchy as they all sort of attack at the same time.
Right. Zombies are the ultimate communal creature in some ways, right? But actually it depends on the movie that you watch. Sometimes you'll see zombies fighting over them. In some of the Of the Dead movies, I think it was Day of the Dead, you see zombies fighting over a prey.
And 28 days later, you actually saw zombies fighting over prey, too. So there is some competition within there. But in terms of why they have this ultimate communal thing, I don't know. I think it probably it's because zombies kind of started as a political metaphor about, like, consumerism and stuff. So I'm going to go with it was more George Romero's social take on society rather than a true neurological root. All right. Well, thank you very much.